Once more under the breach, dear friend.
Let's close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And I always forget what to do at that point. I'm sure there's something I'm supposed to do here. Oh, yes. Oh, yeah.
We have to disclose
and disclaim.
Disclose. No disclaim. We're not claiming that we're not claiming. That would be disclaiming.
Actually, there's a little bit of a disclaimer in there. Anything we say cannot be used against us in a court of law.
Oh wait, that's our
that's the Miranda.
No,
right.
That's the opposite of the Miranda says anything you say can be, and if you say anything we say can't be, that's like the un-Miranda rights. That'd be pretty awesome.
You'd have to spell Miranda backwards.
Yeah,
and Miranda.
Oh, yeah,
something. Like, anyway, the Personal Wealth Coach is also not only a radio program, which I think you probably have deduced from the fact
that you're
listening on the radio. It is also the name of a firm, an investment advisory firm in Salado, that's based in Salado, Texas. And the same two guys, bald-headed guys, who are the principals there, are the principal speakers here, and that's not a coincidence. And the regulator, which regulates both us and them, and all of us at the same time, is the United States Securities and Exchange Commission.
Yep.
The stuff we say on here, the information we give, is informational, it is educational, but it is not considered to be investment advice, because investment advice is given to individuals based on their individual conditions and circumstances and not broadly like in this radio program.
Yeah.
And the sources from which we get our information are sources we have deemed and conclude are usually quite reliable. And we are very careful about that, but we make no warranty or guarantee as to the accuracy of that information. Last but not least, anything you hear on here is the strictly Personal Wealth Coach stuff, information, factoids, whatever, and has nothing to do with Town Square Media except for the commercials. Now, if you hear commercials on here,
that's not us.
That they have strictly to do with Town Square Media and have nothing whatsoever to do with the Personal Wealth Coach. And we have a caller on 773, which, by the way, is the telephone number, area code 254-773-1400. So, caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, enjoy the show. Your newsletter said that Social Security had to dip into the trust fund for the first time.
Yep, or will be dipping in this year.
So my question is it truly a trust fund? And if it is, what are they invested in? Or is it just a bunch of IOUs? I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Well, yeah, that's a great question.
It's an interesting.
The answer is yes.
Yes and yes.
The trust fund money in general is IOUs. The trust fund is special treasury bills, bonds, and notes, mostly bonds. Special bonds that are held on the books, they're not held by the public, where Congress has issued a U.S. Treasury bond to represent that they spent the money on something else in the general fund.
Is it a real trust fund? Yes. You know,
it's as much a trust fund as any pension.
I've been involved in providing securities for trust funds off and on for many years. And in many cases, the trust funds have restrictions on them that says they can only use bank CDs or treasury securities, which is exactly what the trust fund is. Is it funny money? No, it's not, because.
Well, sort of. It's funny in that if you think about any money can be funny money when you think about it enough.
You have to first start off with what is money. And if you say money is something of value that you can use like a chicken, then you really don't have money. You have a barter economy. Money, by definition, and it starts back with Rome.
How is it that we always go back to chickens when we say bartering? It's like our go-to reference.
They're very chickens and cigarettes were the standard medium of exchange.
Carry them upside down. They're pretty docile.
Chickens transfer easily, and they pay interest in the form of eggs. You can eat them. So you've got a lot of advantages to chickens. Cigarettes, they're not so much anymore, but chickens and eggs still constitute value. The term money comes from mons junos, and it is the Romans decided that they didn't like the idea of using precious metals or chickens and things of that nature, that it was inefficient.
Precious metals, heavy. Chickens in bulk are hard to carry around. If you're trying to buy a house and chickens, you're going to have a pretty big briefcase.
Well, there's a going exchange rate, which you had to really stay on top of, between chickens and cows. And I guess you could buy a house for cows. But
you could.
But the issue is that the initially they used a semi-precious metal called electrum, but then they realized that people were just melting it down and using it for their own purposes. And
so then they electrum-plated things.
And they ultimately came to the point where there was no precious metal, just like the U.S. currency today. There's no precious metal in it at all. It just simply had a stamp on it, generally with the emperor's face, which means that if you defaced it,
that
means you
shave
some of the value off of it. But the point is that the most efficient money in history has been what's called fiat money, which is money that basically, if it's printed by a government, it's backed by the full faith and credit of the government, including the armed forces. Therefore, it's worth it. It is a store of value, and it is a way of transferring value from one person to another.
All right. There was a big movement in the mid-1600s to go to paper, and it didn't start with a government. It started with banks. It started in the Netherlands, and basically what happened is that the Netherlands was the center of commerce for the entire world at that point. Everything, and to some extent, there are still parts of commerce that it is. If you're talking about flowers, quite a lot of organically or hothouse grown things, it's still the center of trade for the world. And the problem is that if you're trying to transport wagon loads of gold and silver from one bank to another to confirm that it exists so that you can pay for something, there's a problem. So they started writing checks, basically check that I have it. I have checked that I have it. It's in my vault. So here's a piece of paper to another bank that says I have it. And at any point, you can show up and get the gold if you want, but we're not going to ship it to you. So this is when paper money's born. It is, in essence, an IOU. It is, I have it. You can have it when you want it. Come and take it. It's available. It is what's called callable. You can show up and I will give it to you. The bonds of the United States government are, to some extent, available for liquidation on the open market. It's not callable to the U.S. government, but you can sell it to another person for real money. Well, what is real money again? Because if you pull out a dollar bill or any other dollar paper currency, you will see on the top of it Federal Reserve note. It is an IOU for another dollar. So to some extent, all money is funny money. Doesn't matter if it's cowrie shells, bitcoins, chickens. If you're not hungry, a chicken's not very valuable.
So let's go to the Social Security Trust Fund. What happens is it's just like the money you have in the bank. The money you have in the bank is not represented by a stack of dollar bills or $20 bills or even $100 bills. It's represented by entries on a ledger. And
electronic ledger at this point.
The ledger entry is what the Social Security Trust Fund amounts to. And by law, the Social Security Trust Fund gathers a certain amount of money out of payrolls, and it deposits it on this ledger. And the federal and it actually loans the government that money. The government then turns around and pays it interest, and that accumulates back to the ledger. Actually, we hit the point where the money going out of Social Security and the money coming into Social Security were in imbalance, where there was more going out than coming in back in 2009. But the interest, accumulated interest on the trust fund, was sufficient to carry us to this point. Well, at this point, in 2018, the Social Security Administration, the Social Security Board of Trustees, actually, has officially announced that they're going to have to start selling those Treasury securities back to the government, which means that now there will be money flowing out of the general budget into Social Security payments rather than the other way around, which is going to put an interesting little crimp. The only way that the federal government can pay those then is to go out and borrow money using increasing the deficit.
Right. So they'll borrow money to pay off the borrowed trust fund. So this is Section 4 of the 14th Amendment. The validity of the public debt of the United States authorized by law, including debts incurred for payment of pensions, that's what we're talking about here, and bounties for services in suppressing insurrection or rebellion, shall not be questioned. Okay, what that means is the validity...
You can't ask any questions if you're talking about it.
The validity of that debt is based on the law that was passed to produce that debt. So... it is a unlike the other debt held by the public or debt held by the Federal Reserve or debt held by someone outside the United States. That must be paid back. That's a constitutional must do. If it's based on another law like the Social Security Act, then Congress can make another law saying we owe it to ourselves so we don't owe it to ourselves. That's up to them. The current law says that once they've reached the end of the trust fund, they've got to drop what they pay to people in Social Security. It's a built-into the equation system. Just like the current tax law says that if we have a sufficient enough downturn in revenue to the government, then we go back to the old tax code. Now, most people don't recognize that. It's one of those things that's built into the system. If we have a recession, we have an automatic tax hike.
Which is exactly what you shouldn't do, by the way, during a recession.
Not recommended. Do not recommend that you raise taxes in a recession. That makes the recession bigger. So the trust fund for the Social Security Administration is real in the same sense that all debt is real. The government has obligated itself to pay. Now, here's where we get into the area where we have some finagle room. The U.S. government, as represented by the Congress of the United States, over many years decided that instead of passing a spending law and a borrowing law at the same time, said that they would pass a spending law, and within the debt limit, the Treasury would just come up with the money. They didn't pair the bills anymore. It used to be two bills for every vote. So you'd have a debt bill that was attached to the spending bill. So they ceded that power to the executive branch and said to the Treasury Department, we talked about this a lot during the Obama administration and some during the Bush administration. The Treasury Department's responsible up to the debt limit for meeting the spending requirements that Congress gives them. Well, then Congress has turned around on multiple occasions, raised their spending way above what would be the debt limit, but then refused to raise the debt limit. So the reality is the trust fund is only as trustworthy as Congress. They can change their mind. Each Congress is not required to agree with the previous Congress.
Well, when you consider that about 20% of America will be drawing Social Security, somewhere between 20 and 25%, when the Social Security system runs out of money, I think Congress will find a way. They'll just pass a bill and say, you get full Social Security despite the fact you haven't paid enough in.
Right.
And you'll just borrow more money. Now, the problem, of course, and here's the issue. First, if there's a recession between now and 2034, the date moves closer.
The date at which the trust fund is empty.
Yeah.
That's 2034 is what we're predicting now, which is a year earlier than what we were predicting
and
before.
At some point... and it may be 2034 before it happens. It may be, I don't know when it's going to be. But at some point, when we start borrowing, as we will this next year, $1 trillion a year, and it'll rise exponentially after that because we're borrowing money not just to pay for the deficit, we're borrowing money to pay for the interest on the borrowed money that we borrowed before we paid on the deficit. The world will decide we really don't want to loan that much money to the United States. And now that may be a long ways in the future. It may be 30 years in the future.
30 years? I'm thinking that I don't believe that 30 years is the, I mean, we're talking 16 years.
No, but I'm saying it could be 50 years in the future. It could be 30 years in the future. It could be 16 years in the future. But that's the thing. It's kind of like if you have excellent credit today and you have a good income and you can then buy a house and buy cars and charge things on your credit card and you still get lots of people trying to sell you, trying to get you to buy new, get new credit cards, and they'd love to loan you money. But downturns come. And when the downturns come, if your pay gets cut dramatically, the banks that are so eager to loan you money right now may change their mind and not be so eager to loan you money. And you may find that a significant portion of your income is wrapped up in trying to pay off your debts, and you can get into a hurt. And that's the thing that we're concerned about with the recent tax cuts and spending increase. It's one thing to do it during a recession. We recommend the government run its deficit up during a depression or recession, because that's how we get out of these things. But we also recommend that when we have good times, and we are having good times right now, when the economy is booming, that's when you the responsible thing to do is to pay down your debts. I mean, if you have you were out of work and you ran a bunch of debts up, and you're on unemployment, and you're running a deficit in your personal household, and you ran up a bunch of debts, and you get a good job, and everything is going really well, that's the time. And Americans do this. We allocate more money to pay down our debt load, knowing that hard times will come again, are likely to come again, and we need to have the ability to go out and borrow money. We don't need to have our credit tapped out to the max. Now, we're nowhere near that in the United States. We're on the low end of the scale in the United States when it comes to the debt outstanding owned by the public, which is the only one that really counts, versus GDP. But when we start borrowing $1 trillion a year and we consciously, in good times, borrow a lot more, spend a lot more money than we're taking in, and we cut our pay. That's what the government has done ineffectively. And one of the keys here, and this is the thing I kind of object to, is the tax cut said, in essence, we're going to stop charging Americans so much tax, we'll put more money in their paycheck, and we'll borrow the difference from overseas. And that way everybody will feel better. And that is irresponsible political demagoguery. Whatever party would choose to do that, it makes no difference. It is incredibly irresponsible, and it's irresponsible particularly in a light of the time when the same government is complaining about trade imbalances, because all the money we borrow from overseas constitutes exports that make our trade imbalance bigger.
One quick note to go back to Social Security and trust funds. There's two trust funds for Social Security. There's the disability side and the old age side. The old age side almost was depleted in 1982. It was during the Reagan administration, and Reagan got Congress to pass one, an emergency legislation that permitted borrowing from the other trust funds. So basically Medicare and the disability side loaned a bunch of money to the old age side. This is where people say this sounds like funny money, but governments and corporations do this. If you're in a corporation, this is probably the easiest way to look at it. If you're in a corporation and you have a budget in your department for $500,000. That's your budget. And you're almost through the year, but you've depleted the budget. You still have to make payroll. So you go to the other departments, and you get a loan from them, and you got to pay it back during their budgetary cycle. So when the government does it, it's very similar, except that the government also has the ability in doing this to add inflation, where in effect a corporation adds a little bit of inflation when it does that, but it's minuscule. When the government does it, it's about 20% of our economy. So when the government does it, it does create more inflation than others. And that's really the trick pony here. This is the deal that we've got to keep our eye on, is that over the last decade, anybody that's listened to us has known that we have not been worried about inflation at all. We're starting to be worried about inflation at this point. We're seeing all the signs that point to, if we save Social Security, how can we do it? Well, first let's say if then how? If we save Social Security, how would we save Social Security? Well, give me one, and I'll give you another one.
Very, very easy way to quote, save Social Security, and that is simply say, if you make over this much amount of money, if you make over, and you can put a pretty high number on this.
Yeah, if you got like $400,000.
It basically, well, $250,000 is the standard
measure
for rich.
You could make it $400,000, and it would still work.
But if you're making $250,000 a year to $300,000 a year, it trails off between $250,000 and $300,000. So people who make over $300,000 a year
while receiving Social Security
in retirement don't get their Social Security. Don't get Social Security.
That's called means testing.
And that would save it.
Another thing: raise the retirement age.
Yes.
Now, if you raise the retirement age instead of means testing, I can tell you without any reservations that there's going to be a lot of upset people.
Well, and the point is, the problem with raising retirement age, and I hope we don't do that.
That's what we've done before.
I know it's what we've done before. But
it's what happened in the 80s.
The problem is, the lower your income, the less you're generally able
to
work
next Fox News 30/30.
Into your beyond age 66, which it's going to go to 67. So at 67, a person who's been in construction work in most cases has reached a health condition that they're unable to continue work.
Right. And that's what I mean about if you don't do means testing, if there are people receiving $250,000 a year and Social Security, and you've got people that are in essence unable to continue to work, they're going to get paid either through disability or through the old age fund. Mm-hmm. And so they're going to get paid either way. It's not saving anything
cases. It's really hard to get disability.
It is. It is very hard
and
to get disability.
And often you have to hire an attorney, and
that's
becoming more and more hard because the disability fund is pretty close to running out of money,
this
too.
This is how the bureaucratic institution that is the Social Security Administration is trying to save the disability fund. Is they just have a knee-jerk no to anybody that applies. I mean, you could be missing all of your limbs, and you may say, no, you're not disabled. You still have a nose.
The problem is we have a record number of people and the record growth rate in the disability area.
Right.
Because, very frankly, there's a lot of people, and most of them, and this is where the big growth is coming from, white men. And middle-aged white men who have back pain, who are on medications, who are in many cases opioid dependent because of medications that they've been prescribed
for other pain,
and so they are becoming disabled, which is one of the reasons we have a relatively low job participation rate in the United States.
So this is the third facet that isn't communicated very much to save the disability as well as the old age fund, is that we've got to change our diets, folks. We can't trust the government to do everything. We've got to take some responsibility. If you're overweight, the likelihood of, particularly severely overweight, the likelihood of you getting a disability is very high. This is very much like the debate that was held for the public good on smoking. I don't care if somebody is smoking. I really think it's up to them. I'm a libertarian on that viewpoint until they're of the age where Medicare starts kicking in. Now I'm paying for your smoking. I don't like that. If someone is doing something that doesn't hurt me, that might hurt them, I'm fine with it. If they're an adult, they know what they're doing, they understand the risks, I'm all okay. If they expect me to pay for their injury, I don't care if it's a child of mine, a cousin of mine, or someone I don't know. If they're doing something that I say, you knew the risks, you need to pay for your pain and suffering. You need to figure out how to do it. Don't expect me to do it. That's where I am. That's not what the law says. The law says if you smoke, you're over the age of 65, you have lung cancer, I have to pay for it. We all have to pay for it. So this is where socialism as a method for paying for things gets into some difficulty. If there is such a good safety net, or at least such a mediocre safety net, now you see how I changed that, as Medicare, if you have type 2 diabetes, there are things you can do to help alleviate that. Over time, the best method is changing your diet. If you are smoking and you're 65, I would refer people to the organ donors list. If you need a new liver, which is not a commonly endangered item when you smoke, and you smoke, they're probably not going to give you your liver because they're going to give it to somebody who's made a decision to stop smoking. If you're still smoking, then they say, we may be fixing this, but something else is going to break. So that's a triage-type situation. We've got to be doing that for ourselves. And this is something that I think most of our listeners agree with wholeheartedly. That's personal responsibility. When it comes to diet, when it comes to exercise, when it comes to smoking, it's up to you how you want to eat. It's up to you how you want to drink. It's up to you how you want to smoke. Until you're drinking and you get on the road and you kill someone. Or you hurt yourself and you expect other people to pay for it. That's where I draw the line, and hopefully others do too, but that's not how we have the law set up right now. And at some point, I don't want to say you don't get medical care because you were smoking, but what do we do in those circumstances? So Social Security on the disability side, which is pretty endangered as well, if we continue to do things as a nation that are bad for us, well, we shouldn't be surprised when the disability numbers are going up.
Actually, the disability fund runs out. They're projecting
further on down the road.
In 2032.
Yeah, so it's 2 years before the old age fund.
The big one, as far as one we're going to have to deal with first, is that Medicare is going to run out in 6 years.
And that's not something people are talking about. That is the big one.
And we...
we didn't do anything to save that in the 80s.
And the recent tax bill, oddly enough, cut, and whether it was intentional or whether they just shot it by so fast they didn't think about it, actually did cut slightly into the revenues on both Medicare and the disability insurance fund. Medicaid is likely to run out sooner. In other words, there's
Medicare.
Medicaid is likely to run out sooner than Medicare. But that's the federal Medicaid funding.
Right.
The reason we bring this up is it is a coming crisis, and coming crises are easier dealt with when you can look down the road and say, okay, this is going to happen. Let's deal with it now.
Rather than waiting for it to be
in other imminent. Words, it would have been a lot less expensive for everybody concerned had the federal government paid attention to New Orleans and said, you know, we got some weak dikes in New Orleans,
yeah,
and
these,
we're probably going to have some
need
break.
Some work.
And by the way, the Corps of Engineers kept telling Congress over and over again, we need to spend a bunch of money on New Orleans because the levees and dikes and gates in New Orleans are old, and in a major hurricane, they're probably going to fail. And of course, Congress then got very, very angry at the Corps of Engineers for failing to maintain them after the Corps of Engineers had said, we need some money to maintain them.
No.
And Congress said, no.
To be fair.
We'll just defer that maintenance.
To be fair, just like you've heard us say in the past, when people talk about the 1% owning so much or their income being so drastically different, and I have said, well, every year that 1% number is different people.
Yeah.
They're not the same people every year. The vast majority of people in the top 1% that are making all that money just happened to sell a business that year.
Sure.
Or came into an inheritance, windfall, you name it. That's how they got up in the 1%. They're probably only going to be there 1 or 2 years their entire life. The same is true when we talk about Congress. Congress was told for many years by the Corps of Engineers, we need to fix this stuff. Congress said, we're going to ignore that.
Wait till the next Congress.
And the next Congress comes along, which is not the same people.
Mostly the same people.
But not the same people. And they can always say, hey, that was a different Congress, even though most of the people in Congress are the same people that were there.
There's about a 2% turnover each year.
Yeah, it's a pretty small turnover. We may see a bigger turnover this year. I don't think it's going to be massive compared to other midterms. It just doesn't look that way in the cards.
The point is that we want to point out a couple of things. And there's something else we can do about Social Security that we're doing the opposite of. We're actually damaging Social Security. And the Social Security Trust Fund, Social Security trustees actually included this in their report. The Dreamers, by saying we're going to deport the Dreamers, by ending the deferred deportation or whatever it was, the executive policy.
Right.
Social Security had to take their future income out of the equation by limiting the and this is the Trump administration has consciously, they've said so, not staffed up the offices that where people apply for a worker visa to enter the United States to do manual labor. Now, the people who come into the United States on a worker visa to do manual labor pay into the Social Security Trust Fund. But by limiting immigration, which is obviously the Trump administration says they want to limit immigration. They want to shrink immigration. By shrinking immigration, we're shrinking the money that flows into the trust fund. We're depending on natural-born Americans, and the problem with natural-born Americans is we're headed quickly to a point where we're not having enough babies to keep the population stable, which means that that puts the trust fund in bigger trouble quicker. Yeah.
So let me begin this statement here by saying we are not advocating illegal immigration. Hear that? I can say it again. We are not advocating illegal immigration. Now I'm going to go on and say a fact. The Social Security puts out a trustees report every year. The first section of the trustees report is called the long-range demographic assumptions for the 2018-2017, name the year there, trustees report. It is one of the major components of the report that says when, how long it's going to be viable. The reason why we're dipping into the trust fund 2 years ahead of expectations, 3 years ahead of expectations, is because we thought illegal immigrants were still going to be paying into the trust fund.
Not just illegal.
It's not just illegal, but immigration.
Dreamers, if you count the Dreamers as illegal immigrants,
they are illegal. Yeah,
but they specifically mentioned the Dreamers as being a significant future contribution because they tend to be educated. They tend to earn a lot of money.
People that have heard us talk in the past or me talk on the past about the educational issues and the fact that the majority, not the plurality, the majority of grad students in the United States are from other countries. If we stop giving them visas, all that high income that they have been earning in the past, which pays a lot towards Social Security, goes away with them. So hearing this, you might say we're advocating for reform for the immigration system. That's what we're advocating
yes.
for. Absolutely. We don't believe people should be breaking the law. If we have a law on the books that says you need to get a visa before you can work here, then you should get a visa before you work here. But if we look at the economy and we see that, you know, this is the thing with the highway department, the 85th percentile. When they check a speed limit, they look at the 85th percentile. That's not always been the case. When Congress came in and said, no, 55, that's the speed limit. Well, nobody obeyed the speed limit. That made a nation of lawbreakers. Now we look at the 85th percentile almost everywhere and say, okay, that's the appropriate speed limit. When we look at businesses that require immigration, if we look at the 85th percentile and you say, whoa, there are a lot of people hiring illegals to do things like pick vegetables and do seasonal labor and for a long time do construction. That's not such a big thing in construction anymore. It's not such a big thing in picking vegetables anymore because we've cracked down so hard on it that vegetables are rotting in the field. That's not good for business. So when we look at this and we say, what is a reasonable law on immigration? Number one, don't be a felon. Number two, have a job lined up.
What's a reasonable law on immigration? Don't be a felon?
Right. Let's say, who do we allow into the country to work? Don't be a felon. Have a job lined up. Have a reasonable expectation that when you're done with your job, you'll either leave or show that you have another job.
Well, this is where, by the way, people who have told me they object to the worker immigration visas.
Right.
Is maybe not the majority, but I think, and it may actually be a majority at this point. Last time I looked the numbers, it was a majority. Of the people who are illegally in the United States came in legally.
Yeah.
They didn't come across. They didn't come across the Rio Grande.
Yeah, the wall would have to be at the airports. That's
right.
Where most of the people that are illegal came from. That's I've said that before as a joke. The vast majority of illegal immigrants came from overstayed visas, and they came through an airport, not across a river.
Well, this is one of those things, though, that when you mess with the law of supply and demand, when you don't have enough people to pick mushrooms, when you don't have enough people to pick
avocados, cucumbers,
name it. The housing industry is saying that we really are limited on how many houses we can start because we don't have enough manual labor workers, and the highway contracts go begging because there's not enough people to do manual labor, and we're in that position right now. Then a sane law says, okay, we need to allow more immigration into the country to fill those job positions. And I really don't think you're going to get a sweeping, overwhelming, although we have gotten a pretty good fill, of people who will come in and then immediately leave. Why not just recognize the fact that we're all immigrants here, unless you happen to be a Native American, in which case you were an immigrant much earlier, your ancestors. We're all the children of immigrants here. And recognize that we need a certain amount of, for our economy to grow, and that's a point we want to get into after commercials.
Right.
For the economy to grow, we either need dramatic rise in productivity, which means more robotics, which means putting a lot of people out of work. So
we're not quite ready to do that. We're talking about half a decade or more before we're ready to do that completely.
Or we need a lot of people coming to the United States to go fill the jobs that are opening up.
But we need to be able to track them. We need to make sure that they're paying their taxes. We need to make sure that every step along the way, we can do this. We have computers these days. We can track people. This is not a unsurmountable issue, but we're at a logjam, and we got to talk more about this after the break.
All right.
If you would like to call in and join our conversation at the Personal Wealth Coach, this is Jake, and that guy over there is Jeff. We're both McClures. The phone number to call in here is 254-773-1400. We'll be back after these commercials.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure.
And we have a caller on 773-1400. Caller, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. The reason for my call, I wanted your opinion on what I'm going to ask you. You know, a lot of people, apparently, they don't look at this or they don't care to look at it. But if you look at a note, it says this note is legal tender for all debts, public and private. Okay, would you say that the reason that they put that on there is because we have so much corruption? You know, money's the root of all evil. You can use it right, you can use it wrong. And another thing, too, they say money has a lot of secrets, identities into it, if you look at any, you know, little details they put into it. And that was my call. I just wanted to see your opinion on what I've asked you about, you know, legal tender. This note is legal tender for all debts, public and private. You have a good day, sir, and thank you for allowing me to talk on your program.
And thank you for calling.
Yeah, I appreciate the call.
There's a couple of points. First off, you misquoted scripture there. It isn't money is the root of all evil. It's the love of money is the root of all evil. It's the scripture. But the reason it is legal tender for all debts, public and private, and a lot of people are surprised sometimes to find places that won't take cash. It is legal tender, but there is no obligation of a vendor to take cash. And it's simply what it boils down to is that is a Federal Reserve note. It actually should be called a bill. It's actually called a dollar bill.
It's a dollar bill. That's what it's called.
And although it says note on there,
Federal Reserve note.
It's very similar to a short term, a 90-day T-bill
or an electric bill for that matter. Well, you're expected to pay that electric bill. Only the credit worthiness is higher than the average of everybody.
What it boils down to is the government says this dollar is valuable. In that if you're paid a dollar for a dollar's worth of work and you take it to a merchant and offer to exchange it for a dollar's worth of goods and or services.
They don't have to question
right. If
that dollar's worth something.
It's backed by the full faith and credit of the United States government. The Secretary of the Treasury and the Comptroller of the Currency both sign every bill that's out there.
You will not find that written on a check from a checkbook. Because a check is not issued by the federal government. It isn't issued by the Federal Reserve. It is a check that is only as good as the signature on the check.
And the vast consumer money, when we talk about the day-to-day consumer items, when we talk about the personal consumption index, the vast majority of that money is in the magnetic strip on your credit card. It's actually
in the
ledgers of the bank. It's in the
new ones.
It's on the chip. Yeah. It's basically an electronic signal. You know, I carry several credit cards around in my pocket. Most of them have borrowing limits of $10,000 or higher. And if you were to add them all up, it'd be a staggering quantity
of
money. That
would be a very thick wallet.
Well, I've actually got quite a few in there. And
yeah, if they were all money, you wouldn't be able
right.
to fit it in your pocket.
But in effect,
very big pockets.
The vast majority of vendors accept that piece of plastic, or as the Germans refer to it as Plastikgeld, plastic gold, plastic money. When somebody says, is the Social Security Trust Fund funny money? Is it real money? Let me ask you this question. Is your credit card real money?
All money that we use as legal tender is debt. I owe you this much money. When you're using a dollar bill, it's the Federal Reserve saying, if you bring this dollar bill to me, I will give you a dollar. That's really what it means.
And it used to be, and I'm old enough to remember when I used to read it and say it, and you could actually go to the bank
and get some silver.
And you could get an ounce of silver. You could get a silver dollar literally they were called silver certificates, the dollars were. And you could go get an ounce of silver, a coin, in exchange for the dollar. But that was when we were on what's called the species or monetary standard, the metal standard, where 1 ounce of gold equaled $1, and 35 ounces of silver equaled 1 ounce of gold. Now, was that the real market value in the world? No.
It was, but because the government set the market value.
All the major governments, which were at that point concentrated in Europe and the United States, all agreed on that exchange rate for silver and gold, and they forbade private citizens from holding gold for the purposes of investment. You could have jewelry, but it was theoretically the artistic value of the jewelry that was valuable. And then we were on the gold standard, and it was really fine until France said, hey, we've been collecting dollars. We've been collecting dollars in Southeast Asia. We've been collecting dollars in lots of places. And because of the Bretton Woods Agreement, where we're all on the gold standard, we're going to send you a shipload of dollar bills, in essence.
Yeah.
And or $20 bills or $50 bills or $1,000 bills.
Direct response later on for us not letting the current Prime Minister of France know about D-Day when it was de Gaulle.
Yeah, and he was back being prime minister at the time, and he basically said, what that would do is it would have taken about 40% of the gold reserves of the United States, and at that point we would all realize that we'd issued a lot more dollars than we had gold to back it up, because very frankly, folks, there is not enough gold in the world to make the United States economy run, much less the world economy. And so going on the gold standard is a phenomenal joke. And the other negative about trying to go on the gold standard, real money, gold, is the fact that gold prices are largely controlled by gold mining in South Africa and Russia. So if the United States dollar was based on the price of gold, the value of the dollar would be in the hands of the Russians and the South Africans, which somehow I think would be a less than ideal situation. And, of course, the problem was the French torpedoed the gold standard, and any country could torpedo the gold standard, and I'd virtually guarantee somebody would. And there's literally not enough gold in the world to account for the value of dollars that we have floating around in the world. So going to the gold standard would cause literally a collapse of civilization in the world, because there wouldn't be enough money. And when there's not enough money, history says there'll be plenty of war, because the people who don't have money will raise armed forces and go take it from the people who do have money. That's a little oddity there. There's another thing, and I'm going on here.
Let me hit something here real quick. Let's see, millions, billions. Okay. We have enough gold on the Federal Reserve books to cancel out a lot of the federal debt. People don't recognize that. We've got about $3.5 trillion in student loans owed to the government. So if you looked at the net worth of the federal government, it's about par now. It's about break even. The debt and assets would make it a net worth of around zero, not counting real estate.
Well, if you count the real estate in, it's they don't have much debt.
Right. So if you were looking at a high-income person that was spending a lot of money, more money than they were making, and they had slowly worked up more or just about the same amount of debt as they had assets, you would tell them, you better stop spending so much, or you're going to have a lot more debt than you have assets. And that's what we're looking at this point. So I realize that's a strange thing. We're getting a lot of questions about money today. And the idea here is that dollars are backed by us, the United States citizens. We as a group say the dollar's what we've agreed to use. And it's not just the United States. It's also the rest of the world.
The Federal Reserve of the United States, the Federal Reserve Bank of the United States, is effectively the Reserve Bank of the world. And they have been tasked with the job of maintaining a fairly constant value in real buying power for the dollar. And they have done the best job of any such organization in history. As a result, people in the world trust the dollar far more than they trust any other currency, including the European Union's euro. The result is that people turn to the dollar, by the way, instead of gold in crises. That's why during the 2009 crisis, the price of gold dropped and the price of the dollar went up. So we've actually got a really good system that works exceptionally well. Congress can always change it. They can change the Federal Reserve Act and decide to institute inflation to get rid of their debt, which is what's happened in Venezuela and a lot of other places. But it would be very unlikely they would do so because, again, it would create chaos around the world. The world, the stability of the world that we've come to take for granted, where there are no major wars, world wars haven't been going on in a long time. We don't have huge cases of countries just going in and wholesale invading other countries for the fun of it and taking them over.
Well,
you impinge into a country to restore a boundary to what you say is legitimate.
Iraq did it, but now we have.
But we kicked them out of Kuwait.
Yeah, we said leave Kuwait. You can't do that. But then Russia's done it in two countries. So they've done it in Georgia and Ukraine.
It's one thing to say, totally invade a country and take it over.
We're getting to a point where we have the entire world has recognized a boundary, and one country violates it. So
this is
it didn't lead to a world war. And
the issue is that in Eastern Europe, particularly, the old boundaries and the new boundaries are not the same, and they were arbitrarily set. Matter of fact, it's one of the biggest problems we have in what we call the Middle East, the Southwest Asia, is the fact that some British and, to some to lesser degree,
French.
Americans and French sat down together and artificially drew lines across what is we call the Middle East, and in doing so didn't really understand what they were doing in terms of the people who lived there.
But the lines look nice and straight.
Yes, they're very nice straight lines, and the end result is that people are fighting over territory that they believe belongs to them. But what we don't have going on in the world is a lot of what we had in World War I and World War II, leading up to World War I and World War II, where countries were just simply saying, okay, Germany saying, okay, there is Poland, Russia, you and I will invade Poland and we'll split it.
Peace on earth. I want a piece of this and a piece of that and a piece of this.
We don't have a country marching into Belgium or Holland and taking it.
And we're about out of time for this hour. There will be lots more to talk about next hour. We just got back from a big conference.
The reason I wanted to bring that up is because it's the dollar is one of the reasons that hasn't happened. We've got economic stability around the world.
So if you would like to talk to us off the air, we actually do give personalized fiduciary advice to people and management of portfolios. The phone number to call locally to reach the personal wealth coach is
254-947-1111.
You can reach that number toll-free for those of you that are still doing landlines at 1-800-914-7526, 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. You can email us directly, jeff at tpwc.com or jake at tpwc.com. And until next hour, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.